a real live specimen. One thing my mouth seems to work better if I have something in my hand. Now, this is an alligator snapping turtle. It's one of the most interesting turtles in the world. This type is the largest of the freshwater turtles found in the Mississippi drainage region. This creature will reach a size of 225 pounds. It's particularly unusual in the fact that it has a lingual lure. On the end of its tongue is a small projection which can inflate with blood, which the turtle will use to lure fish, which he will consume. Very interesting creature. I brought him along just to use as a jumping off place into our topic this evening. Take a look at his legs. They don't look very much like our arms and legs, yet the bones found in these appendages of the turtle are similar to our own. There will be in the upper part of the foreleg, the humerus, then comes the radius and the ulna, the carpal bones, metacarpals, and phalanges, the same as we have in our arm. And in the rear leg, we'll have the femur, with the tibia, fibula, the carpal bones, metacarpals, and phalanges. The same pattern that found in us and a variety of other turtles. We'll put him back. Hope he'll behave himself and not cause any trouble. Now, Darwin looked at a variety of forms. I'm not sure he looked at the alligator snapping turtle, but he looked at dogs and cats and birds and porpoises. And he came to the conclusion that the similarities found in these varieties of animals indicated descent from common ancestors. Now, before Darwin, before Darwin, the categories found in the animal kingdom were ideal plans or types conceived in the mind of God. So it was God's plan for creation. But for Darwin, it was common ancestors. So this is a distinction between these two positions. So this subject is homology. And this homology to Darwin seemed to demand that these forms were related. At least it provided powerful circumstantial evidence for the macroevolution claims of Charles Darwin. Let's take a look at homology in a little bit more detail. Owen, in the 1840s, defined homology as essential similarity. Similarity in relative position and connection. Thinking of the turtle, thinking of the man, the forelimbs are attached to the pectoral girdles, the hind limbs to the pelvic girdles, and very similar position and connection. Adult structure, same basic bones they found in these limbs, and then the embryonic development. Now, we're going to see as we go on tonight that the first two of these are okay. There's a lot more questions about the third one, and I think this is very significant. Ancestry is not needed. And I want to add here that the opposite of homologous is non-homologous. This is a perfectly good term to use today, and I think we hear frequently in the evolutionary community that there's another term that if something isn't homologous, usually it snaps over to something else, which we'll be talking about later. But I think it's better to think of it as non-homologous if they're not homologous but suspected of being so. Let me illustrate homology. The bones here pictured in a bat, a bird, a man, and a horse. And here we can see the humerus, the radius, the ulna, the carpal bones, the metacarpals, and the phalanges. Now in the bat, you can see that the there's a difference between the bat and the bird. Now, the bat, we have the metacarpals and the phalanges and elongated considerably. The bird, these are shorter. But still, the basic pattern is there. Here are the legs of some turtles. First of all, the desert tortoise. Now, these turtles are found out in the western United States, the Galapagos Islands, some other islands, South America, Africa. This is the type of turtle that has a reputation for being slow moving. And here's a sea turtle, a loggerhead with large flippers. They swim very rapidly in the sea. But in their limbs, hind limbs and the forelimbs, the same basic bones will be present. So indeed, these limbs are homologous. Now, another term is analogy. And this refers to similarity in use. This was Owen's terminology. No prerequisites regarding structure. And this is not the opposite of homology. I want to emphasize that fact. Let's take a look at an example. Here we have the wings of the bird and the bat. We already looked at the bones in both of these. They have the basic bones of the forelimb. There are some differences here, but the same basic bones are present. These organs are homologous. They function in flight, flying, therefore they are analogous. So they're both homologous and analogous. The butterfly down here is an arthropod insect built on a different plan. The wings are used for flying, similar to the bird and the bat, but they don't have the same essential similarity, adult structure, connections, so forth. So the butterfly would be analogous with either of these, but non-homologous. Now, I'd like to look at homology since 1859. Darwin said that homology was one of the most, Denton, I'm talking about Michael Denton, and I've taken some material from his book. If you're not familiar with that book, I think and you should be, if you're concerned about the origin of history. I have a copy of the book right here. It's probably the best anti-evolution book that ever was written. Denton is a MD, PhD, an Australian scientist, and he pulled together a lot of very valuable information in this book, and he goes back to a typological approach to nature. He pointed out in his discussion on homology that one of the most powerful lines of evidence is the concept of organic evolution. Darwin himself said it may almost be said to be the very soul of natural history. Now, I started college back in 1946. Just come out of the Navy, I was saved, became a Christian while I was in the Navy during the Second World War. I'd never had biology. I came to the University of Massachusetts, and I was hit with a botany course that was strictly evolution, and then into the zoology course. And I can remember very clearly that we were taught that homology was similarity based on descent from common ancestors. Now, we're not just defining the term, but we're telling why this condition exists. That's what we had to put on our tests, and I, not knowing any better, did so. I wanted to pass the course. Similarity due to descent from common ancestors. This is built, of course, on Darwin's idea. Gould has said that Stephen Gould from Harvard is probably the number one evolutionist today. I think if you would mention a name, a leader in evolution, it would probably be Stephen Gould. The central task of evolutionary biology is the separation of homologous from analogous likeness. So this is a very important concept in evolutionary study. Tracing this whole line of the development of the various structures. I think there's another viewpoint that we want to mention at this time, and that is that these could be the evidence of a common designer. Now, I'd like to go back and look at embryology and take an overview of what's going on in the embryology, at least a certain form of life. Here's the sea star, or the starfish. It's not really a fish, so some of us would prefer to call it a sea star, although popularly it's the starfish. Any kind of germ is supposed to be on the evolutionary line leading to the vertebrate, which is our line. The one cell, egg, are being fertilized by the sperm. Then this cell divides. It's the cell division, which in embryology is called cleave. Cell division. Cleaves into two, then four, and this division continues to 8, 16, and we don't always keep an exact number from here on. I mean, the number will vary. They don't all divide in synchrony. But you round up and you get this morulous stage. This stage goes to the blastula stage. And here we have a hollow ball of cell. Then a very important event occurs in its gastrulation. And in the early stage of this, you can see a little impulsion here in this blastal estate. Then it goes in farther. At this stage, we have what can be recognized as a two-layered structure. Previously, a single layer. Now, there are two layers. Here is the gastral estate with the two layers further developed. As time goes on, other tissue develops between these two layers, so we have three, an outer ectoderm, an inner endoderm, and then a mesoderm in between these two layers. Now, these three basic layers will develop into all parts of the embryo. The outer layer will be the skin, the nervous system. The inner layer will be the lining of the digestive tract. Now, there are some organs that evaginate from that inner layer, the liver and the lungs. Pancreas come off from that inner layer. The parts of them come from that inside lining. The middle layer constitutes the main mass. I'm thinking of our own bodies, for instance, the muscles and the bones come from that middle region. And here we have an antioxidant, which is also believed to be on the line leading to the vertebrates. And you can see basically a two-layer structure here, and then a third layer by a somewhat different process starting to develop. Now, here are some blastulas of a number of other vertebrates, along with a couple that we talked about already. The echinoderm, the sea star, you can see the blastula stage. Here's the frog. It looks similar to that. Here's the blastula of the bird, and then the mammal down here. Now, when these go into gastrulation, the processes are quite different. Talked about the echinoderm invaginating to give us the two layers. In the case of the frog, there's a place over on the side where the material begins to roll in and goes up and forms the layer. I have some models of frog embryology here on the table. Now going down to the bird, it's quite different still. The bird embryo lies on top of the yolk, and we have what looks like a two-layer structure here. Some question that this is really underdermis interposition. But what happens is, to get the middle layer, it comes in and goes out in both directions, quite different from either of these two processes. We look at the mammal, it's even different still. Start with an inner cell mass and focal blast. The process of gastrulation and inner organogenesis is different from all of these other ones. Now, this difference among these has been observed, but still many evolutionists have felt that, well, that these still bear relationship to each other. The question is, does the similarity indicate a descent from common ancestors? Well, I think it doesn't. These differences among the embryos are so different that it raises a serious question here. Now, we talked about the basic development, embryology, the organs being developed. As Ben says, the organs considered homologous in the adult cannot be traced back to homologous cells or regions in the earliest stages of embryogenesis. So homologous structures are arrived at by different routes. Now, this is very strange when you think about it. We have organs that basically are very similar, but they are arrived at by a different procedure. The blastula formation, gastrulation, they're different in these various organs, but yet the organs come out to be not all that different in the adult. Now, we mentioned that before Darwin, different types thought of as variations on God's plan, manifestations of a great theme. And we will be coming back to that idea again. Darwin, when he talked about homology, and I took this from the Sixth Edition of Origin and Species, he said that homology is the relation between the parts which result from their development from corresponding embryonic parts. So he tied in not only the adult structure, but also the developmental process. Now, and his ideas have worked their way right down through biology in the last better than 100 years. And I mentioned previously, this is basically what I was taught as a student. Now, there's been some change of thinking in recent years. William Ballard was at Dartmouth College, very boldly came out 1976. He said, only by semantic tricks and subjective selection of evidence can we claim that the gastrulas of sharks, salmon, frog, and bird are more alike than their adults. We track these things down, and do we find similarity back at the basic developmental level? No, we don't. A very significant paper was published by D. Louise Ross. Last I knew, she was at Duke University, 1988. She had written a previous paper in 1984. And in that paper, she echoed the Darwinian idea that homologs must share developmental pathways. Similarities must have a similar developmental process. She said, I acknowledge, but I did not confront some of the difficulties with this approach. The current paper addresses these problems, and with the exception of that particular point, I stand by the other conclusions in that paper of 1984. But now we've come to the position that homologs don't share similar developmental pathways. Now, the pioneering work on the development of this realization that we have organs that are similar, but they result from different processes of development, was done by Gavin De Beer. Gavin De Beer was a professor of embryology at the University of London. He was the head of the British Museum of Natural History, director of that organization, a scientist of no mean status. He's written a number of books. I remember reading one of his books on evolution some years ago. And very, very strong evolution. But it was he with his book, Embryos and Ancestors, who helped to debunk the popular embryological argument for evolution. The idea that as an embryo develops, it goes through the various stages represented by its ancestors. I can remember as a freshman at the university, that idea of the developmental process showing the embryonic, showing the evolutionary development. And I was very convinced of that. I said, how could anybody doubt evolution if the embryos go right through the process and they show the fish stage and maybe a reptile stage going on up to the mammal stage? I later went back and I did a master's degree in embryology. My advisor was a Harvard PhD. This was at the University of Massachusetts. And he knew that I had some doubts about evolution. In fact, when I had been a freshman at the university some 6-7 years before, I had given him a hard time in my ignorance. Now I was back as his graduate student in embryology. And one day he said to me, I want to tell you something, Wayne. He said, evolution has done a lot of harm in the field of embryology. He said, we've only had one Nobel Prize winner in embryology. That was Needham, the German experimental embryologist. He said, we should have had many more. But he said, because of evolution, we've gone down a lot of blind alleys, dead ends. Haven't gotten us anywhere. He said, recapitulation does not work in embryology. And he said this back about 1952, he said this to me. He said, there's too many exceptions to it. Now, Gavin De Beer had said this some years before, but it was just getting into the embryological community at that time. And the idea of the evolution of process being recapitulated, summarized by the embryos, has died very hard in the evolutionary community. But now, evolution is generally recognized that it's not a good argument for supporting a macroevolutionary viewpoint. But Gavin De Beer had a large role to play in this, in getting this type of thinking into the scientific community regarding embryology, and now he's done a similar thing with regard to homology. In 1971, he published an Oxford biology reader. And he said here, the characters controlled by identical genes are not necessarily homologous. He goes on, homologous structures need not be controlled by identical genes, and homology of phenotype or appearance does not imply similarity of genotype. The DNA that Perry Fink was talking about a while back, the DNA that causes us our bodies to be what they are. That's the genotype. It now is clear that the pride with which it was assumed that the inheritance of homologous structures from common ancestry explained homology was misplaced. This was the Darwinian position, and there was pride connected with it. For such inheritance cannot be ascribed to identity of genes. The attempt to find homologous genes except in closely related species has been given up as hopeless. What mechanism can it be that results in the production of a homologous organ? The same patterns, in spite of their not being controlled by the same genes. I asked that question in 1938, and it has not been answered. He suggests that whether homologous structures are controlled by non-DNA mechanisms awaits further research. The title of this publication is Homology, an Unsolved Problem. Now, I'd like to consider with you now some examples of the way organs develop and how they're not controlled by these similar genetic mechanisms. And just summarizing the work of Devere, apparently homologous structures are specified by quite different genes in different species. Let's take a look at the limb of vertebrates. I've already said they have the basic structure. One bone at the attachment of the limb, two bones distal to that, the humerus or the femur, carpal bones, the tarsal bones in the ankle, metacarpals in the wrist, metatarsals in the ankle, then the phalanges. This basic pattern is there in the various vertebrates. And they develop, interestingly, from different body segments in many of the creatures. For instance, in the newt, these limbs will develop from segments 2, 3, 4, and 5. In the lizard, 6, 7, 8, and 9. In man, 13 through 18. Denton says it might be argued that these limbs are not even strictly homologous at all. If we look at the fish, which is supposed to be the ancestor of the vertebrates, we find that the forelimb of the fish comes from stromata. These are blocks of tissue that run alongside the early neural tube to become the spinal cord. In the mammal, the limbs come from the condensation of lateral mesoderm. It's much further out in the embryo. They're quite different. And another problem that we have is looking at these limbs with this pterodactyl pattern, which is common throughout the vertebrates. The five digits on the forelimb and the hind limb. And the limbs are very similar, with the one bone, two bones, and then the tarsals and the and the carpals. And then the five digits. Now, these limbs come from different parts of the body. One comes from the pectoral region, the other the pelvic region. They're supposed to be derived from the pectoral and the pelvic fins of fish. Now, why is it that they follow the same basic pattern and they're not even related? I mean, this is just a way of illustrating the fact that the similarity is not due to common ancestry, because it's right in the one animal itself, but they come from different parts of the animal, and yet they still have a very close similarity. If we consider the alimentary canal, the intestine of a variety of animals, they develop differently. These are some examples that the deer has given us. The roof of the embryonic gut cavity for the shark. From the floor of the embryonic gut cavity in the lamprey and newt. From the roof and floor in the frog. In birds, reptiles, from the lower layer of the embryonic disc. Now, the spinal cord. take a look at the development of spinal cord construct. I'm just selecting a few examples to illustrate why some of the scientists feel that this is the situation. Here's the development of the neural tube, the spinal cord of the frog. The ectoderm, the outer layer, folds up, and then these two layers join together, and this tube pinches off, and we have the hollow tube that later will be the spinal cord. Here's a, if only six. A block of tissue drops down, and then it's hollowed out. Now, this is a different process, quite a different process. This process is called cavitation. It's a destruction, an autolytic process in which the cells in the center of that block are destroyed. It's similar to the destruction of the tadpole tail in metamorphosis, where we have these cells are destroyed. And that leads to the production of the tube. That's very similar to the spinal cord up here in the frog. Now, what I've been talking about here for these vertebrate animals is also true for other types of animals, including insects. And plants as well. Well, there is a process in which one gene will often influence many characteristics. Here's a transparency of what happens with the condition of sickle cell anemia. This is primarily in Africa. And if people have the right genes for this, it will affect many of the organs in the body, the heart, the kidneys, the brain. The lung, multiple effects from a single gene, apparently. This phenomenon is called pleiotropism, or some people sometimes call pleiotropism. Here's a chicken, and it has normal gene is shown here on your left. And the recessive gene for the abnormal characteristic is over here on the right. We can see the normal features of this chicken over here on the left. There are down feathers, the wing, the lung, and then a peculiar feature in birds, the air sac that penetrates the bones of the bird. Here's the kidney, and then the foot. Many of these organs are affected by this recessive gene, a pleiotropic effect, multiple effects from a single gene. Now, some of these organs which are affected are homologous with the organs of a variety of other animals. The lung. Frogs have lungs. Reptiles, various reptiles, snakes, lizards, turtles have lungs. And that's an important organ in studying the evolutionary viewpoint, looking at homologous organs. Yet there are some unique features for birds as well. These air sacs that fill the bones, the down feathers, unique for birds. And yet this particular gene influences both types of organs. So there's evidence here that non-homologous genes affect a variety of organs. Some of them homologous and some of them non-homologous. These effects, as I say, go across a variety of organisms. It just shows the complexity of the whole problem. But at least it's clear that that the developmental process can't easily be tied in with a simplistic view of the evolutionary process. Here's a quotation from botanist. In general, the homology of structures such as organs or molecules cannot be ascribed to inheritance of homologous genes or sets of genes. Consequently, organ homology cannot be reduced to gene homology. And he quotes several others, I think these are primarily in zoology. They recognize this too, and therefore they suggest as an alternative, listen to this, to reduce homology to a continuity of developmental information. It's not the same as the genotypic nucleic acid. Now, what is passed from generation to generation and conveys the genetic information? It's DNA, or some organisms, RNA, nucleic acid. That's what carries the information. Now, what he's saying is, it's not the continuity of the DNA, but he's saying nothing, really. He's saying it's a continuity of information. I mean, it's just a word covering ignorance. But the point is that it's not the DNA that's carrying it. It's just information. Somehow, organisms, he's saying, have evolved, and they've passed on the knowledge of how to make these organs, but they don't do it by means of the genetic material. Now, I mean, it seems odd that a first-rate scientist is going to come out with this sort of thing, but it's just an expression of ignorance regarding this matter, I think. It'll be interesting to see how he's thinking a little while from now. Now, I'd like to move to a consideration of biochemistry. What the terminology that has permeated biology in the various fields, this homology, and it, when you see things that organs that are similar, it indicates an evolutionary relationship, has now permeated into the biochemical field. And when similarities have been seen among biochemicals, and I'm primarily talking about the macromolecules, the proteins, and the DNA, the nucleic acids responsible for them, it said these are homologous. Now, this has had a double meaning, and the same as homology of the bone. You can say that these have a structural similarity. That was Owen's definition. And it's perfectly valid. Or you can say they're descended from common ancestors. But homology is really just an indication of descent from common ancestors. And the same thing is, I said, in biochemistry. But what they're thinking of is sequence similarity. Rather than the bumps on the bones and so forth, it's in the sequence. Now, just to show some of what of the complexity of this problem, here's a little diagram illustrating what happens in the development of the proteins in body organs. We have our DNA, and I'm glad Terry went over some of this a little earlier. DNA forms the RNA, which leads to the production of the protein, and then this protein is important in the construction of the organs in the organism. Now, the RNA has a three-letter code. These are called the codons. And I've listed codon for five amino acids here. Leucine, valine, glycine, lysine, and tryptophan. These particular codons will be responsible for these amino acids being brought in to form a protein. Now, it's not just one group of three letters that can bring in the same protein. In the case of leucine, there are four of them. Valine has four, glycine is four, lysine two, and tryptophan is only one. I've listed the different combinations of nucleotide bases that can cause this to happen. So you multiply these together, and you get 128 different nucleotide chains that will produce an identical, well, this it's a small peptide, and you'd need maybe 50 of these joined together to get the smallest protein. But the, you can see the tremendous number of different combinations of these letters that can produce the same protein. It just illustrates the complexity of the problem we're dealing with, but it's not easy to track the structural homology down to a biochemical homology. Francisco Abaquiz has kind of summarized what I think is a good viewpoint to take on this subject. He says evolutionary considerations are considered as secondary, because what matters are the processes that realize a body plan, not whether a shared plan implies the same ancestry. Under this perspective, perhaps a return to the pre-Darwinian concept of homology will be more useful to biologists. He says, let's restrict the term homology to morphology or form and not use it in molecular biology with these chemicals. And I would agree with that very much. We're talking about DNA or a protein. I think we should say sequence similarity. And if that means common ancestry, okay, but I think in most cases it's very risky to suggest a common ancestry based just on that. So, in conclusion on this, I think we have to be very cautious in extrapolating from the morphology and going back to the chemicals that have caused this structure. Now I've listed non-random mutations on our outline next, and I'd like to comment briefly about these. In the last year or two, we've heard about these studies that have shown that the popular evolutionary view of how organs develop is maybe more questionable than we thought. They've done some studies with Escherichia coli, for instance, and found that this organism would develop mutations or genetic changes in response to the environment. Now, the evolutionary view is that mutations or evolutionary changes are random events. They just happen. And then the environment selects the good ones and preserves them for evolutionary advance. So this is mutation and natural selection. This is the essence of evolutionary thinking. Now, the organism just mutates randomly, and then the good ones get selected. But in this non-random mutation, the environment is affecting the organism to change in a beneficial way. And with these Escherichia coli, they don't normally utilize lactose, this milk sugar. But when that was present, they mutated in a way that enabled them to utilize this sugar as a source of energy. And the probability was up into the millions, or even toward a billion times what would be expected on the basis of chance alone. Which is saying there's something else that's involved here. It's not just a mutation and a natural selection process that's going on. There seems to be that the organisms can respond to their environment positively. It's like a fly being in a DDT infected environment and responding by switching some of their biochemistry over to protecting themselves against the DDT, and then they will survive better. It's that same idea. Now, if that is the case, then what is being thought of as homologous maybe in many cases will really be analogous, or what the Platists today are calling synapomorphy and switching it over to homoplasy. So it complicates the picture.
And it raises some more doubts about the idea that the homologous structures have bear a relationship by descent. The idea that why is the penguin the same shape as the dolphin, which is basically the same shape as the fish? Well, they all live in an aquatic environment, and so in order to survive best, they have that shape. It's not because they're closely related. And this may be true for all kinds of organs, and I think the non-random mutations have tended to support that idea more. All right, I'd like to think with you now about the implications for us of what we've been talking about so far this evening. And to do so, I'd like to look at the levels of causation regarding the development of the living thing, or their origin. We can deal with primary causation. Either there's a supernatural power behind the development of living things. This is God's choice. This could be a personal God or a non-personal God. Non-personal God of Plato, Aristotle. We, of course, as Christians, believe in a personal God, a God who is concerned about organisms, concerned about us as individuals. The alternative position, naturalism. The universe is self-sustaining. The universe, life, that creates itself. This would be based on the properties of matter. The universe is self-sustaining. I put down chance for this, just the alliteration, choice, and chance. So, category number one, primary causation, either A or B. To go to secondary causation, and here we're looking at the actual material. What do we learn by observing nature? Now, it's been pointed out by Geisler and others that we're not dealing with science in the strict sense when we are looking at the past history of life, for instance. It's history. You can't recreate it. You can't falsify it like we can with other experiments. You want to test fertilizer on the grass, you get a control plot, experimental plot, and you can falsify a conclusion. Somebody else can do the experiment. Well, some have said, let's call them models rather than theories. Well, I don't have strong feelings about that. But I do think that the level of the science theory is not the same as with reproducible, falsifiable science. So the secondary causation number two, the question is, do we have abrupt appearance or macroevolution? Is it true to be or not to be? The abrupt appearance model says that there were many kinds that are not related, and there were limited changes within these kinds. The more popular macroevolution view, large-scale change, in other words, had one starting kind and large changes. The abrupt appearance model can be categorized by a forest of trees, the roots of which are not related. But there are branches on these trees, and one of these trees would be the human race. White, black, yellow races. And we could have turtles on another one. The three, four different basic types of turtles and varieties among them. The abrupt appearance model. This is the popular model of creation. And I think it's one feature that unites the creationists with various viewpoints about other matters, including catastrophism and ages. The alternative to this is macroevolution, the large-scale changes, where there's one tree and the living organisms are found at the tips of the branches of the tree, of this tree, the single tree. Now, what we've been talking about today, I think, tends to lend more support to this type of a model than it does to this one. I've heard and read many of Usman's talking about the continuity of the genetic information. But now we find that the genetic information doesn't seem to be going along with the structure. I've heard evolutionists sometimes mock those who held this kind of a position. They said, if God were going to create things different and separate from one another, why did he have the same genetic material that carries through all of them? Well, I think that the new information we have regarding homologous structures not being related to homologous biochemical material tends to add more support to this kind of a viewpoint than it does to this viewpoint.